U.S. and Iranian officials have returned to the negotiating table. At the same time, an American armada, as President Trump calls it, is being deployed nearby.
The escalation between Iran and the United States can get quickly to a very, very dangerous stage.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. What both sides are seeking in this new round of talks, and the firestorm caused by the Epstein files has now reached across the Atlantic to Europe and 10 Downing Street in Britain.
The victims of Epstein have lived with trauma that most of us can barely comprehend.
Also today, a new animated kids movie that uses time travel to highlight the achievements of Muslim men and women.
These wonderful women in the past were superheroes of their time.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us today. We start in the Gulf country of Oman, where officials from Iran and the U.S. met earlier today to discuss Iran's nuclear program. The top line out of today's meeting is that the talks are going to continue. These negotiations come at a time of great tensions between the two sides. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following all of this. Shirin, can you set the scene for us? Who all was there?
Yeah, so Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and his team, along with the Omani officials, from the U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner were there. This was not a face-to-face meeting.
Shirin, does that mean that two camps are like in different rooms and the Omani officials are going back and forth between them, delivering messages back and forth?
From what we saw in the photos and the footage that came out, the two sides are not in the same room, but we don't know what happens behind the scenes. And
Okay. There
is a lot to consider when it comes to the optics for these sides when they're negotiating. They have to be careful about who they shake hands with, who they're photographed with. So there's a lot to consider here.
Interesting.
But let me also take you back to the days leading up to these negotiations. There was a lot of back and forth about even the venue where these talks are going to take place. And initially, it was supposed to take place in Istanbul, Turkey. But the Iranians wanted it to be changed to Muscat, Oman. That's where the talks took place today. And one notable presence today in the room was the head of the U.S. Central Command, Admiral Brad Cooper. He was in his uniform, something that's not typical for these types of negotiations. I spoke with Arman Mahmoudian about this, and he's a research fellow at the University of South Florida.
Trump has displayed a tendency of, you know, wanting to bring people in the uniform into the negotiation and meetings. And the second, earlier this week, the United States CENTCOM shot down an Iranian drone. This proves that, or displays that the escalation between Iran and the United States can get quickly to a very, very dangerous stage.
As you know, Carolyn, the U.S. has sent a large amount of military equipment to the waters near Iran, and that includes aircraft carriers, other warships, fighter jets, spy planes, and air refueling tankers. So there's a lot going on in that region.
Right. That's what President Trump has called an armada that he has sent to the Gulf. But if these talks are set to continue, does that mean, you know, a military strike from the U.S. is off the table for now?
Not at all. The president and his administration, people like Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, say that the military option continues to be on the table. In fact, just yesterday, Caroline Leavitt said President Trump wants to see if a deal can be reached, but he's also ready for other options as well. And remember, just back in June, when there was a war between the U.S., Israel, and Iran, in the days leading up to the attacks, the U.S. and Iran were negotiating. They were at the negotiating table. So this is not off the table at all.
So let's get into the topics of negotiations. What does the U.S. want here, and what do the Iranians want?
Well, the U.S. has a whole list of demands here. It wants Iran to stop enriching uranium and to ship its highly enriched uranium stockpile out of the country. U.S. officials say they want to pressure Iran about its missile program and its support for regional proxy groups. So a whole list here. But if you read statements from the Iranian officials, they say that these talks are only about the nuclear issue, and that's all. What Iran wants, look, Iran is coming to these negotiations on the heels of a brutal crackdown on protesters. Last month, thousands of people were out on the streets demanding the downfall of this government. So for the time being, it seems that the Iranian government is hoping to use these talks to remain in power.
So I'm wondering how the protesters are reacting to this meeting between the U.S. and Iranian officials.
Some Iranians see this as a positive step. You know, they say this is avoiding an all-out war. Military option is never good. But at the same time, for many, this moment feels like a betrayal. One person I spoke with yesterday, he told me that thousands of people didn't die for a better nuclear deal. Mm. And remember, as these protests were building up last month, President Trump posted on social media telling Iranians to, quote, seize the institutions and that help is on the way. He also said that at the beginning of the protests, that killing the protesters is a red line for the U.S. Arman Mahmoudian told me that for a number of Iranians, they saw these comments as an encouragement to keep protesting.
So for the people of Iran who went on the street, endangered their life, good number of them being killed, that was a promise of a leader of a superpower, that you go to the street, I have your back. This is a backing that, you know, you count on it.
Now, the Trump administration is negotiating with the very people who are responsible for the killing and arrest and intimidation of thousands of Iranians.
One last question, Shirin. I'm wondering about the big fleet of U.S. ships near Iran. Is there any situation where the U.S. might just move that back as these talks continue?
One thing we know about President Trump is that he doesn't like to show weakness and that he doesn't have much patience for rounds and rounds of negotiations. So what Arman Mahmoudian told me is that what we might see is an intense focus on getting a deal.
He made comms to the Americans and says that, look, I made a deal that nobody else could make so far. You know, I got these concessions and I didn't use for power.
And a reminder, Caroline, that the U.S. and Iran did have an agreement that they reached during President Obama's term. Trump walked away from it in 2018, saying that he wants to make a better deal. This might be the better deal that he's always been looking for, given that Iran is in a weaker position right now. So we might see Iranians willing to make more concessions this time around.
The world's Shirin Jafari on top of all of this. As always, thank you for chatting with me.
You're welcome, Caroline.
Three million pages, 180,000 images, and 2,000 videos. This is what made up the latest batch of material released from the Epstein files by the Trump administration. Connections between the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein reached far beyond American borders and across the Atlantic. In Britain, Scotland Yard has opened up a criminal investigation into a former UK ambassador's links to Epstein. As the world's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, that's just the start of the fallout so far.
Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, has weathered crises before, but nothing quite like this one. Yesterday, he apologised to the victims of Jeffrey Epstein, even though he has never had any dealings with the convicted sex offender.
The victims of Epstein have lived with trauma that most of us can barely comprehend. I want to say this. I am sorry. Sorry for what was done to you. Sorry that so many people with power failed you.
Just a year ago, Starmer gave Peter Mandelson, a prominent figure in British politics, the plum job of US ambassador to Britain. The latest batch of files show that Mandelson maintained a close friendship with Epstein, even after he was convicted of solicitation of prostitution with a minor back in 2008. This week in Parliament, the UK's opposition leader, Kemi Badenoch, demanded to know what Starmer knew when he gave Mandelson the job.
Did the official security vetting he received mention Mandelson's ongoing relationship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein?
So clear. Prime Minister?
Yes, it did.
Mandelson completely misrepresented the extent of his relationship with Epstein and lied throughout the process.
Mandelson features almost 6,000 times in the Epstein files. But it was an exchange between the two men in 2009 following the global financial crash that's proving to be the most damaging.
It's absolutely stunning. I mean, I'm almost speechless recounting it as an example of ministerial transgressions.
Martin Farr is a senior lecturer in contemporary British history at Newcastle University. Mandelson, who was Britain's business secretary at the time, is alleged to have sent sensitive financial and political information to Epstein, including documents meant only for the eyes of the Prime Minister.
I know of nothing which approaches a cabinet minister giving market-sensitive information during a financial crisis to foreign parties and encouraging foreign parties to actually destabilise and weaken his own government for financial gain.
This week, Scotland Yard launched a criminal investigation into Mandelson over alleged misconduct in public office. Lawmakers, including some MPs in Starmer's own party, are still calling on the Prime Minister to step down. Starmer's troubles are a welcome distraction for Buckingham Palace. The latest files give more details of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew's, ongoing friendship with Epstein. Keir Starmer said this week the former prince should testify before US Congress. In Norway, it's the crown princess that's making headlines.
The latest release of the Epstein files contains hundreds of references to the crown princess, including personal emails between the two appearing to show a close personal friendship.
The questions it has raised here in Norway is why did she engage in this communication with a man who she should have known that he was a convicted sex offender.
Trina Arlesen is editor-in-chief of the Norwegian newspaper Aftenposten. Crown Princess Mette Marit is mentioned nearly 1,000 times in the files. She apologised, saying she showed poor judgment, and a vote in the Norwegian parliament this week shows overwhelming political support for the monarchy. But Arlesen says the public aren't so sure.
Normally that the support is around 70-80%. Now it has fallen to around 60%. But more serious for the Crown Princess and the Crown Prince is that half the Norwegians now say that they do not trust that she is to become the Queen of Norway.
Last night, two more prominent figures in Norway, the former Prime Minister and the former Foreign Minister, were also reported to have appeared several times in the documents and are being investigated. In some European countries this week, the attention has been on the survivors. In Latvia, police have launched a criminal investigation into allegations that Latvian nationals were recruited for sexual exploitation in the US. In Lithuania, prosecutors are undertaking a potential human trafficking investigation. But Epstein survivor Jess Michael says she believes many powerful figures featured in the files are still being protected.
The fact that there were so many parts of it that were redacted. The only thing that was supposed to be redacted was victims' names. No one was supposed to be protected, and that is not what happened.
Michael says she was 22 years old when she was raped by Epstein. She was a professional dancer, and the assault happened on the first and only day she worked for him, back in 1991. Michael says it changed her completely.
It destroyed my sense of self. I felt like my body betrayed me. I lost trust in everyone around me because it was a friend that sent me to him. I lost trust in the world around me. My immune system broke down, and I was never quite the same. And hopefully I'm changing that now, being closer to that 22-year-old girl.
The past week has been hard, she says, but seeing the reaction of the authorities in some parts of Europe is giving her hope.
The way the international community is responding is extremely refreshing. And it's really demonstrating for us as survivors that people are actually taking this seriously, as opposed to how our current administration is.
Michael says she's not sure the full details of the Epstein files will ever be fully known. But she continues to speak out, she says, in the hope that nothing like this will happen again. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. And now we bring you chocolate. Cacao has a long history in Latin America, where it was once revered by Mayans and Aztecs. On that continent, one ancient variety of the plant used to produce a beloved chocolate had become incredibly rare. Until not long ago, it turned up on the other side of the world. Danny Mitzman brings us the story from the Philippines.
If everyone has a dream job, Trina Texan certainly has mine. She's a certified chocolate taster, as well as a cacao evaluator and craft chocolate maker. She comes from Manila, but this evening on the Filipino island of Negros, she's introducing me to a chocolate she considers incredibly special.
Friollo Filipino Aromatico, that's the variety. So what do we do? So we look, no blemishes, perfect, shiny. We listen, there's a snap, so it's well-tempered. We smell. So we don't chew it. We don't want to swallow it.
The chocolate we're tasting is made with an award-winning cacao cultivated on this island, an heirloom variety called Criollo. It's grown by local farmer Christopher Fadriga, who, in almost fairy-tale-like fashion, discovered his precious cacao beans by chance.
I had no knowledge about cacao about 10 years ago. I was more of a natural farmer. I was growing vegetables.
Chris, as he likes to be known, had never considered cultivating cacao until a client recommended he give it a try. He sent Chris down south to a cacao seminar in Davao on the island of Mindanao. It's where 80% of the country's cacao is grown, and its chocolate is considered the Philippines' finest. When he got back, he started doing his own research on the internet.
And that's where I found out that the Philippines was the first country to receive cacao outside of the Mesoamerican area. These are cultivars that came from Mexico when they were colonizing the country. Usually the friars would like to drink the secuate or the hot chocolate, and they would bring it wherever they established a community.
As the Philippines are made up of thousands of islands separated by sea, cross-pollination is less likely. Chris realized that a lot of cacao trees on his island might still be the ancient variety. With this newfound knowledge, Chris began a painstaking search.
I made it my mission to look for remnants of this old cacao. And what I did, I would go around the province, and if I see an old cacao tree in somebody's backyard, I would ask for a pod, and I would do a bean cut test, because I read in the internet that a Criollo cacao is usually white bean.
Slowly and methodically, Chris would collect pods and cut them open, hoping the beans inside would be white.
As I went farther out of the cities to the mountainside, I started seeing cacao trees having the white beans. I was posting it in Facebook. I was asking people if they have notice a white bean cacao growing in their backyard. And they would say, Chris, I think my grandfather has that in our backyard. So that's how it all started.
Chris collected around 20 cultivars of white bean cacao, which he planted in his nursery.
And this became the mother trees of the original plants that I started to propagate.
Fast forward 6 years when a chocolatier friend suggested he enter his beans in a cacao competition. Farmers submit fermented dried samples, and judges like Trina Texan grade them according to parameters including taste, appearance, and moisture levels. Chris was curious to see how they'd do, but never imagined what was to come. Having won the regional heats, he won the national competition, beating even the renowned producers down south in Davao.
After a while, I got a call from the head chef, Chef Jill Sandique.
Jill Sandique is one of the Philippines' top chocolate and cacao tasters and a member of the grand jury of the International Chocolate Awards.
She said, you know, Chris, to be honest with you, When I saw your beans, I told myself, what is this small beans doing in this competition? Because all the other entries were large beans. She told me, but you know what, Chris? When we opened your bag, for the first time, I had goosebumps.
In just a few years of experimental cultivation, Chris's cacao beans were now flying across the world to be judged at the Salon du Chocolat in Paris, representing the Philippines at an international level. And he won gold.
Chef Jill Sandique, she called me and said, Chris, I told you so that your beans will be a rock star in the international competition.
It was a bittersweet win. No chocolate pun intended, because the very next day, Chris's prize cacao plantation was devastated by a typhoon.
Yeah, it was overnight, but I have always been a farmer. The weather has always been part. Yeah, it did not discourage me. I revived the trees and we kept on propagating.
Chris's discoveries soon reached the ears of Dr. Wilbert Phillips Mora, a Costa Rica-based expert in cacao genetics.
And so Dr. Wilbert Phillips came here, and what he told me, he has never seen a place with so much Criollo.
In Latin America, pure Criollo was almost wiped out by a cacao blight in the 1700s. Cacao production there was only saved thanks to cross-pollination, producing the Trinitario variety.
But prior to the Trinitario, it was really Criollo that is a very delicate flavor. It's fruity, it's nutty. And it has a balance for chocolate, and that's what gave the gold.
And that's what Trina Texan wants me to experience, tasting one of Chris Fodriga's dark chocolate bars. Doesn't take much persuasion.
Okay, so we'll smell it. What do you smell right now?
Paradise.
We're smelling an 80% bar, so this is very pure, very little sugar, and just the cacao. That's it. That's what it is. So I'm smelling a bit of caramel, a bit of like sugar, but dark sugar, and then we can taste it. What do you taste?
Quite sour.
Sour. Is it like wine? Because for me, it's like wine. It's literally one note.
Dr. Wilbert Phillips, he told me, Chris, the Philippines just don't realize it, but that is a national treasure. And I believe that there is a super Criollo waiting to be discovered in somebody's backyard.
And Chris and his cacao lived happily ever after. Although, like all the best tales, there's an epilogue.
I had Mexicans who came, and they knew that the Criollo cacao that we are growing here came from Mexico. In fact, they were telling me, Chris, we want our Criollo back in Mexico. I said, that's already ours.
For the world, I'm Danny Mitzman, Negros, the Philippines.
And in Thailand, for many voters, a young progressive candidate represents hope for an end to a long pattern of military coups in the country. But there's a lot of uncertainty even beyond this weekend's election. That story is coming up. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There was some horrific news out of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, today. A suicide bomber attacked a mosque during Friday prayers and killed more than 30 people, with dozens more wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. This was the latest incident in a string of violence in the country, as Pakistan's security forces fight an insurgency concentrated in the province of Balochistan. Akbar Notizi is a reporter for the Pakistani news organization Dawn. When we spoke today, he gave me the latest from Quetta, the regional capital of Balochistan.
Well, as far as today's attack is concerned, this is not something new that has taken place. These kind of attacks on Shia Muslims, they are known as a minority in Pakistan, have been targeted in the past by Islamist militants.
And the attack today was on a Shia mosque?
Yeah, it was on a Shia mosque.
Right. So Pakistan has seen suicide bombings like this before. It has seen attacks on the minority Shia Muslims before. What about recently? Can you tell me more about about the violence that has been happening recently in Pakistan.
In Pakistan, the violence is taking place for quite some time now. In Pakistan, two districts, which are known as Balochistan, which has a border with Afghanistan and Iran, and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, which also shares a border with Afghanistan, these two provinces have been hit by militancy for quite some time now, for more than two decades.
Has that violence intensified in recent weeks, or is the military crackdown in Balochistan a periodic thing?
Yeah, let me tell you, Balochistan is Pakistan's largest province, which is located in the southwestern part of the country, and it shares a border with Iran and Afghanistan and the Arabian Sea. So in Balochistan, the Baloch separatists have been fighting the state of Pakistan from day one.
The Balochistan separatists, you said, who want a separate state for Balochistan.
Yeah, this is the fifth insurgency in Balochistan, which started back in early 2000. So in recent weeks, they have carried out big attacks in Balochistan.
So this is an intensified violence by the separatists in Balochistan.
Yeah.
But it is ongoing.
Yeah, of course. This is an intensified violence in Balochistan, and Balochistan has experienced its largest ever coordinated militant attacks.
And the military has been cracking down there recently. It said it has killed over 200 insurgents in its recent operation. Can you tell me more about the government and military response?
Yeah, Pakistan military says that it has killed 216 fighters in Balochistan's campaign. The military says that operation began, on January 29 against the militants, which carried out attacks in Balochistan's 12 cities. So they have been cracking down, and they have claimed to have killed 216 fighters in Balochistan.
Is this a part of a larger pattern of insurgent violence increasing, the military cracking down?
Yeah, actually, Balochistan is strategically an important province in Pakistan. And more importantly, Balochistan is known as the resource-rich province of Pakistan. This is one of the reasons that the Baloch separatists are fighting the state of Pakistan. And then China has been heavily investing in Balochistan for over more than two decades. There are copper projects which are located in Balochistan being run by China. And in recent years, the Canadian company, which is known as the Barrick Gold, has also come to Balochistan. So mostly Baloch separatists, they're opposed to the foreign investments. That is why, they have carried out such a big-scale attack to just give a message to the foreign investors.
Oh, interesting. So that's what's behind the uptick in recent violence, is that the Baloch separatists are trying to say, we do not tolerate this foreign investment in our region.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is why they carried out the attacks.
And where do things go from here if this is a pattern that is familiar?
Well, I think in Balochistan, as I told you earlier, this is not for the first time that these kind of attacks have taken place. And this is the fifth insurgency which is ongoing in Balochistan since 1948. So, the situation is going from bad to worse. And I'm afraid it will further escalate in the coming months and years. Because as far as the issue in Balochistan is concerned, it is a political question which needs to be resolved politically. But unfortunately, from day one, it has been dealt with force. And as a result of that, problems have further compounded in Balochistan.
Mm. So going back to today's news, which happened in Islamabad, the capital, not in Balochistan, it obviously raises questions about security. What are authorities saying they're going to do to respond to that attack?
Authorities, they say that they are holding responsible the neighboring countries, Afghanistan, as well as India, because Pakistan has already been at loggerheads with India from day one, since its creation. But in recent years, things have gone bad with Afghanistan as well.
Mm. So, Akbar, the government is blaming Afghanistan and forces from there for the attack today. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And who exactly are they blaming? And is there any evidence to that?
Actually, in the past, Islamists have carried out these kind of attacks in Pakistan, especially the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is a banned Sunni extremist group in Pakistan. And then they've also blamed the Islamic State in Pakistan, and Islamic State in the past too has carried out these kind of attacks. So they are also saying that they might carry out these attacks.
So what happened today in Islamabad is consistent with past attacks by so-called Islamic State?
Yeah, it is.
What would you like people to understand about what is happening in Pakistan that they might not already know?
As far as this insurgency is concerned, the security situation in Balochistan has further deteriorated. And even a couple of days back, the Baluch separatists carried out attacks. I mean, in a just single day, they attacked 12 cities. So this is something big. I mean, I've been covering Balochistan province for over the last 15 years. This is a big, big, big attack that has taken place in my journalistic career.
Wow.
And this is not going to stop here.
That was Akbar Notizi, a reporter in Balochistan. In Thailand, voters will take part in a national election on Sunday. The political party leading the polls is young and progressive. But even if they win big, there is no guarantee that they will get to lead. This is a country where elected prime ministers are often stripped of power before finishing one term, sometimes before they even take office. As Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok, many Thai voters are hoping this time will be different.
Everyone in Thailand remembers their first military coup. For Natapong Ruangpanyawut, a tech entrepreneur, his first coup was in 2006. He was in college, and he says it was weird how society sort of shrugged. Like, here we go again. If coups actually fixed problems, he says, Thailand would be the most advanced country on earth. That's Natapong on a recent Thai podcast. He is now 38 and running for prime minister. Thailand has had more military coups than almost any other country, 13 since the 1930s. And it's not just coups. Courts, aligned with the military, have disqualified elected prime ministers over and over, deeming them unfit to rule. Natapong says this keeps dragging Thailand backwards. With his clean, casual look, lots of sharp blazers and no tie, he is the face of Thailand's progressive movement. His party, the People's Party, is favored to win the most votes. Their platform is left of center. Limit work weeks to 40 hours, more maternity leave, root out corruption. The trick is convincing people that voting still matters. Consider a first-time Thai voter like Kirati Purahong, an 18-year-old high school student. Every single elected prime minister in his lifetime has been pushed out of office by a coup or a conservative judge.
The conservatives have sabotaged a lot and it's really bad. But I think this time they already think it through and maybe we can only hope for the best.
His generation has a slang word for what some might call a deep state, an unelected network of army generals and judges and corporate interests that meddle in politics. They call them dinosau, which means the dinosaurs. Kriang Sak Jaran Wong Sak, a Thai political analyst, calls them the old establishment.
There is a constellation of older people who are in the older establishment who are deeply concerned of the potential havoc that's going to happen if you let the youth, the radical youth, run the country.
Kriang Sak is a former leader within Thailand's oldest party, the Democrat Party, which is associated with the old establishment. One thing that worries them is the progressive faction's attitude towards the Thai monarchy. Thais are taught from childhood that the royal family is above critique. Defaming them can lead to 15 years in prison. In the last election, in 2023, the leading progressive party pushed to soften these laws. That led to courts dissolving the entire party. And it also turned off some conservative voters. That's Guy, a 29-year-old office worker who only gave his first name. He says left-wingers can do whatever they want except mess with that law. Kriang Sak, the analyst, says the progressives might stay out of the crosshairs this time if they tone down their message.
I hear it all the time that the older people who are more open-minded like myself would be willing to let the young people do what they want if they're a little bit wiser in the way they make their statement. They're too radical, and then therefore it caused concern.
The People's Party is trying to shed its activist image. It's bringing on more corporate types, tech executives, economists. There's even a few over 60. As for amending that super strict law on defaming the monarchy, here's Natapong, the progressive candidate, in a recent interview on Thai TV. Let me be clear, he says. Changing that law is not part of our platform. This election is supposed to steady Thailand's political situation, which is now wobbly. The current prime minister, Anutin Jeanwitakun, was never elected by voters. He's an establishment figure who only came into power after courts kicked out two left-of-center leaders back-to-back in the span of a year. Voters like Watana Watananon, a 24-year-old engineer, say surely the old guard must know people cannot tolerate more meddling. The powers that be have made so many bad decisions, she says. We just want someone new. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
A movie about four time-traveling kids is hitting theaters this weekend, and when it does, it'll make history. The Canadian film will be the first animated feature film made by, for, and about Muslims to get a nationwide theatrical release in the U.S. The movie is called Time Hoppers: The Silk Road. It follows the four friends as they battle villains and protect historical figures during what's known as the Golden Age of Islam in the 9th century. Fleur de Lisa David is the film's co-director. She joins us from Calgary to tell us about it. Fleur de Lisa, what was the inspiration to make this film?
Well, it's really about the kids, right? You know, it's incredibly important for kids to see themselves as heroes and to see their culture and history celebrated. And especially, I think, today, you know, when Islamophobia is still very present in our popular culture. So really, for us, this is a conscious effort to counter that narrative.
Each of the four characters have a lot of personality, which really comes through in how they are drawn. Can you describe, like, the approach you took in terms of crafting their appearances and how you draw them?
Yes. So we have Layla, Khalid, Aisha, and Abdullah. And we wanted to sort of showcase the different, we wanted to be representative of the different learning styles. For example, Khalid is a book smart. Mm. Aisha has this physical smart, and Abdullah is the street smart guy, and Layla has the, emotional intelligence. And Aisha is with a head covering, or what you call a hijab. And, you know, we have a lot of kids throughout North America that wear a hijab for a choice. It's their choice, right? And so we want them to know that they can be a superhero in their own movie. And that's the same thing with all the characters, right? We want them to be highly relatable to kids. They all have their lovable strengths and insecurities. And so these are things that kids really understand and empathize with.
And what are these four kids up against when they go back in time and try to protect these famous figures? Who are they facing off against, and what do they have to do?
Well, they have to be brave. They all need to be brave in order to, you know, defeat this time-traveling evil alchemist, Fasid. And so, you know, I guess, and that's really one of the messages that we want children to learn, is that, you know, as they grow up, they're not always going to be with their parents, or their parents are not always going to be with them. Mm. And so we want them to see the world as something that they can embrace and love and be part of. And as they encounter different situations and people and places, we want them to be brave.
You said you really wanted kids to be able to see themselves in these characters. I'm wondering if that influenced your decision to make this an animated film that perhaps people might be able to map themselves onto easier than a live-action film.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, we really wanted it to be something that be fun for kids as well, right? I mean, you know, there's a little bit of course, education attached to it, where, you know, we're featuring different times and people and places in history. I guess that's where the time traveling aspect comes from. So, you know, we wanted kids to imagine that they can actually time travel, and that, you know, there's ways for them to be creative when, you know, we're showcasing their stories on screen.
Mm. In your film, these kids do a lot of action scenes or, you know, jumping from rooftop to rooftop. I'm curious what it means to you personally seeing, for example, a girl in a hijab doing these scenes, you know, being the superhero of a film. What does that mean for you personally?
So personally, for me, you know, I actually do also wear the hijab, right? And unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, I have, you know, I've been told that I'm less than somebody else. And so it has definitely an effect, right? I mean, it affected my self-esteem for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, especially as a Muslim woman, for me, you know, we've had great heroes and, you know, great inspirations in the past that have done amazing work, like Fatima al-Fihri and Maryam Astrolabi, Lubna of Cordoba, right? So these wonderful women in the past were superheroes of their time. And so, you know, after reading that, for me was, you know, a revelation that, yeah, I can be one of those, right? And I'm hoping the same thing for children, especially the ones that wear hijab, that this is something that they can see, that they are the superhero and that they can be brave to face any, you know, anything out there in the world. And the world is ready for them to conquer.
Even without their parents by their sides.
Yes, even without their parents by their side.
Flordeliza Dayrit co-directed Time Hoppers, The Silk Road. It opens nationally this weekend. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There is a major trial underway in Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia. It is actually a retrial involving a businessman taking the stand for the third time. He is suspected of ordering the killing of a journalist named Jan Kuciak and his fiancée Martina Kushnirova in 2018. Two previous verdicts in this case were overturned by Slovakia's Supreme Court due to flawed assessment of evidence. Many believe that judicial independence in Slovakia depends on this trial turning out differently. DW's Rob Cameron reports.
Čaute. Jak ste na tom vy dvaja dneska?
Petr Bardi, editor-in-chief of the news website Aktuality.sk, discussing coverage plans with colleagues as the court case gets underway. Petr was Jan's boss and was in regular contact with him until the day in February 2018 when he was shot dead in his home along with his fiancée.
I was helped a great deal by Jan's parents and Martina's mother. They told me I shouldn't blame myself. They said it couldn't have been prevented. The investigators and police officers who worked on the case told me the same thing. I've had to learn to live with it and accept that I couldn't have protected him. He was supposed to be protected by this state, not by me.
The families of Jan and Martina are finally hoping for justice, although reaching a verdict is likely to take up to a year or even longer. Kuciak's unfinished final story had been on how the Italian drug cartel, the 'Ndrangheta, had managed to infiltrate Slovak business and political circles, including people close to Prime Minister Robert Fico. Ultimately, however, prosecutors said Kuciak's killing had nothing to do with the Italian mob. Investigators managed to piece together the sequence of events that led to a former soldier named Miroslav Marček standing on the doorstep of the couple's house in the town of Velká Mača at 8:21 p.m. on February the 21st, 2018. Marček later confessed he'd been approached by his cousin, a former policeman named Tomáš Sábo. Sábo refused to testify, but it later transpired he had been recruited for the job by a pizzeria owner in financial difficulties named Zoltán Andruško. Andruško, who later cooperated in return for a lower sentence, testified he'd been approached by a woman named Alena Zhuzhova, who'd offered him 50,000 euros and another 20,000 euros in debt relief in exchange for killing Kuciak. Zhuzhova was at the time a fixer for one of Slovakia's richest and most powerful businessmen, Marian Kočner. Marianne Kochner had been the subject of several stories by Jan Kuciak, stories that Kochner didn't like. Both Kochner and Zhuzhova categorically deny any involvement and have been cleared twice for lack of evidence. The court has begun a full evidentiary hearing, re-examining all the evidence and how it fits together. It's a process that will likely take a year. Investigative journalist Pavla Holtsova, who worked with Jan on the 'Ndrangheta stories, said she had to remain hopeful.
I have to be hopeful. You know, I don't really want to admit that this could be yet another retrial and then retrial, because I think it's dragging way too long. I believe in justice. I believe that in Slovakia there is still, in many of the cases, independent justice. But I also hope this time that the families could have some kind of a closure, because it's really exhausting for them.
All five defendants are behind bars, Marček, Sabo and Andrushko for Jan and Martina's murder, Kochner and Zhuzhova for separate serious crimes. But both Pavla Holtsova and Petr Bardi are dismayed that the people in power at the time of Kuciak's killing have slowly risen back to the top. Tibor Gašpar, who resigned as chief of police in the wake of the murders, is now an MP in Robert Fico's Smer party. His son is in charge of Slovakia's intelligence services. The victims' families still blame Gašpar Sr. for failing to act on Kochner's threats to Jan. And Robert Fico, the man who critics say has contributed so much to creating the whole edifice of corruption and cronyism in Slovakia, is back in office. His government has dismantled the National Crime Agency, an elite anti-corruption police unit, as well as the Office of the Special Prosecutor. Both were central to corruption investigations launched after Jan Kuciak's murder. This is Rob Cameron in Bratislava.
Rob reported that story for Inside Europe from our partners at DW. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Colombian rock went through a psychedelic phase in the 1960s, but since then, it's kind of faded. That is, until a trio called Baltus came along. If you need a label for Baltus, you could do worse than World Psychedelic Funk. The trio formed in 2020 and likes to improvise in live shows. They draw inspiration from everything from Middle Eastern melodies to disco beats, surf rock, and funk. Baltus played South by Southwest in 2024, where guitarist, vocalist, and band co-founder Balthazar Aguera told radio station K770 that the style of music they're making is uncommon in Colombia.
There are very much thriving music scenes over there, but it's definitely not our style. Hip-hop is huge there. Obviously, as you might know, reggaeton is just huge over there as well. And obviously, like, cumbia and Latin stuff. But, you know, funk never got there, you know, and psychedelic music never got there either, which I find very ironic because Colombia is very psychedelic.
He's talking there about the ancient practices of some indigenous groups who use psychedelics in spiritual ceremonies. As for modern psychedelic music in Colombia, Baltus seems to have cornered that market. Balthazar Aguera might be one of Colombia's most ardent boosters of the Grateful Dead, the psychedelic folk export from the U.S. Baltus covers Birdsong by the Dead. The song was part of a show in San Luis Obispo in California a while back. Recently, the band has been touring Europe and the U.S., and next month they drop their new album, Transmutations. Sun-Colored Eyes from their album Harvest plays us out today. The World comes to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and online at theworld.org. As always, thank you for being with us. I'm Carolyn Buehler. Have a great weekend and come back again on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.